Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, August 15th. Today we hear from the governor about his upcoming trip to the Democratic Convention. The first Maui fire survivors are settling into temporary housing at the Kala'i Ola project in Lahaina. Hawaii's largest independently owned pet store, Petland, decides to cut its losses and close its last retail store after nearly 80 years. And The Right to Read, it's the title of a film being screened in Honolulu tomorrow. We'll explore why literacy matters. Plus, thriller on Oahu, championship dancer Tony Meredith teaches us some moves for an upcoming Halloween flash mob. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii Governor Josh Green will soon be heading off to the Windy City to attend the Democratic National Convention. We spoke to him early this morning about that and the pending global settlement over the claims filed by victims of the Maui wildfires. Here's the governor.
I'm so honored to get to go to the DNC and to support, I think everyone knows, Kamala Harris, our vice president, and Tim Walz, one of my governor colleagues and a dear friend. My family's close to Kamala and Doug, and we're excited for her. Everyone else will have their opinions on Election Day. But I'll be at the convention, and I'll be sharing all sorts of things. But speaking as a physician and the head of our delegation from Hawaii, I do want to talk about women's reproductive rights for the 65 million women who are of reproductive age, and make the case that that's an important thing to consider when they choose our next president.
I know in the last month or so that you have really been behind whatever decision President Biden made about, you know, his reelection bid, but he did come to that decision to step back.
He did. And, you know, I knew all along it was highly probable that the president, after the debate performance he had and the fatigue factor of this four-year experience, I knew it was very likely that he would make that decision. Now that he had come to that space in life, you can argue and talk about whether he should have done it sooner all day long. People have their opinions. Also, whether he should have ever done it at all, because, you know, very few presidents, if any, I think maybe with the exception of President Johnson, who was dealing with the Vietnam War, have ever decided one term was enough. But President Biden was in a unique place after 40 years in the U.S. Senate and years as a, you know, a vice president to make this decision for the country. And I knew as I was traveling with family on the mainland and we had scheduled an event for him, I knew that it was possible that he would make that decision right in the middle of that trip, and we would pivot very quickly to our trusted vice president, who, by the way, has earned many votes over the years. People say she never had a vote cast for her to become the nominee. That's, of course, nonsense. She was in it to maybe the final four or so the previous time, and then the whole country voted for a ticket which said Biden-Harris. So my take on this is Vice President Harris has had tens of millions of people vote for her, and I think that's going to happen again in November.
Well, you know, she has certainly recharged this race. Donations are pouring in to make this ticket happen. What else do you plan to be emphasizing at the convention?
Well, I will emphasize, if asked, how in this case, the Biden-Harris administration really came to Hawaii's aid in our time of need. Over $3 billion has already come to us from the federal government, and another $2 billion on its way, it appears, to help us recover from the wildfires. And I've had an open channel to the president, to the vice president's team, Homeland Security, FEMA, HUD. I mean, they have been good to the state of Hawaii, and that's important. And the relationships that I have merit my support for sure, but this is not a partisan thing. I mean, people should know that they stepped up when we had a natural disaster, and they were very professional and very compassionate. So I'll probably be sharing that story. And there are other ones. There are fun ones, too, about about the vice president and the president, which over time I'm happy to share. I will tell you, it's really interesting to be that close to people that are at the highest office in the land and to find out that for the most part, they're regular people. They're real human beings, which is maybe a little more than I might say about the other ticket. So it's an interesting situation. I'm going to say my piece on their behalf, and I'm going to do it across the party lines because I've always had an ability to also speak to at least moderate Republicans and even some conservative ones when there are real decisions on the line. And maybe that will make a difference. But it's exciting to get to go over to Chicago to do this.
We are just coming off the commemoration of the wildfires. Is there anything you want to add about the progress that we are making? Because I was impressed just, you know, in the 6 months time difference in actually seeing the work there. It's been tremendous clearing all that debris.
Thank you. Yes. Well, first off, my heart continues to be with the families that lost a loved one, and that's why we settled the case. I'll talk about that in a moment, perhaps, because they deserve to have resources, as does anyone who lost a home or was a renter and lost what they had. We have to help everybody, businesses. Kudos to the mayor who has, you know, has kept his head about him and is helping in this recovery in every way. He's there for his people day and night. The tragedy occurred, and, you know, we all are judged in different ways, but he really has brought people together. And so that's incredible. The debris clearance is now over 99% done for the residential lots, which is amazing. I've also made the commitment to the president that we would get that done. We've started building 1,044 transitional homes, some of which are done and people have their keys. And that's going to just ramp up like crazy each month. We had 50 houses dedicated over in Kapalua a day or two ago. You know, it's something to behold. So the clearance and, you know, acquiring properties and making sure we're building housing. So the recovery is on its way. The first year was about survival. The second year is about rebuilding our lives and the lives for our friends and family on Maui.
Well, you know, on our flight over and back, we were with many construction workers. You know, they said, yeah, we're out there building the homes. You know, we expect to be there, you know, maybe close to November, but we're going to try like heck to be out by September because they want to see those homes up and help the families there.
Yeah, it's incredible. I'm pretty stunned in a positive way that the transitional housing is just leaping up off the ground. And then there's going to be a long-term housing boom because 3,071 families were displaced, thousands of houses, of course, burned. And now with the settlement monies getting sorted out, a lot of people are going to get very significant checks to make the difference between what they got from insurance and what they need. And that's going to mean a lot more contracts and architect work and construction work. So whatever we lose in tourism, which people have wanted tourism to slow a little, we will gain and then some in rebuilding. And so that's economic, but it's also healing. And we've got so much building to do. We've already begun to contemplate a small village for construction workers to be able to come and stay so they can stay for the whole week rather than have to fly back and forth to Oahu or from wherever. It's going to be a lot of reconstruction for families, but that's a really good thing. There are big decisions that are still out there, but during the one-year celebration, we tried to also demonstrate thoughtfulness, and that's why we're returning Moku'ula, the cultural corridor, back to the people of Maui. The details are going to be finalized over the coming months and years, but the state has now given that land to the county and to the people. And that means the traditional piko, if you will, of Lahaina is there, and the water's being restored, and the water for the whole Ahupua'a is being restored. There's a lot to announce. We probably should save some of those announcements for when Kamehameha Schools and the state and the county are ready to make big announcements about additional housing. But that's a teaser for you.
Okay.
And, you know, and then what I would focus on, if people are interested in kind of the real action in the moment, is when the insurance claims, the word they use is subrogation claims, when those things finally get resolved and all of the settlement is kind of signed, sealed, and delivered. I'm pushing very hard on that because I watched what happened in California where, you know, more than half of the resources were taken by that industry back. It's unacceptable to me, and these resources have to be there in the community in order to build homes, in order to build clinics, in order to help people survive.
I think many people, you know, would like to see this global settlement. You know, there's still some that are uneasy because we still don't have a cause, but they do want to see healing happen quickly.
Yes, and so getting a settlement done won't prevent us from sharing what happened, although if people are reading newspapers and listening to HPR and paying attention, they know that the accident had multi-factors. It had, of course, its component of the wires going down in a terrible storm, and there was the enormous impact of thick grasses, which were on everyone's properties, and, of course, a storm that had winds blowing 74 miles per hour, sending embers far faster around the community than any superhuman or superhero firefighter could get to a mile away. I mean, that's unfortunately the impact of climate change combined with man-made factors. It's not rocket science beyond that. I mean, that is what happened. And at the end of the day, the settlement that I hammered out with all the parties and the mediators really amounted to what people were capable of paying without having to go bankrupt. And if people go bankrupt, whether it's HECO or the county, then there would be very little, if any, resources for our loved ones that lost so much. So the state is contributing modestly. Kamehameha Schools is contributing modestly. And a lot of that money is coming from insurance claims already anyway. But I just fought to prevent anyone from gouging us. And then the one nuance of the settlement, which I want people to understand, so I hope listeners are hearing this, is that though the county will pay very little up front because they didn't have extra resources after paying for a lot of infrastructure, they will be contributing the entirety of what comes from HUD, Housing and Urban Development, that disaster money, which we're expecting to be over $1 billion. And we're grateful to the congressional delegation for going to fight for that. All of that money will be going towards infrastructure and housing, making it, you know, not a responsibility of the taxpayers and not a responsibility of any other parties. So it was very challenging to get this far in the settlement, and now things are being finalized, but this will bring a lot of money more quickly and a much higher percentage directly to the families in our state. And that is, I hope, something everyone is able to see and appreciate, that it just was better for our local people to get their resources now and to heal rather than wait 4, 5, 8 years through trials and appeals and infighting and then ultimately settlements. I've learned by watching these other states, and I didn't want to see us make the same mistakes they have.
Well, Governor, I appreciate your time this morning, and safe travels.
Thank you so much.
That was Hawaii Governor Josh Green, who we talked to earlier today.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the distance learning executive MBA and Master of HR Management. Scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
On this week's Wait, Wait, we ask Hillary Rodham Clinton the question everybody else was afraid to.
Have you ever seen Pete Davidson's tattoo of you?
I have. Not in the same way other women have.
I was about to say. And Peter Sagal will join us for an intimate look at Ms. Clinton, plus Natasha Lyonne, Chris Pine, and Zazie Beetz. That's the News Quiz from NPR.
Beginning Saturday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
The first 9 families who moved into temporary housing on Maui last week are settling into the units that look very different from what you would normally see. These are quite modern-looking glass structures. It's called the Kala'i Ola Subdivision, which means Place of Peaceful Recovery. HPR reporter Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so you got a chance to go into these modular units.
I did, and they're really nice. I have to say they take beautiful advantage of the stunning views overlooking the water up on the hillside there above Lahaina. And they're very modern, as you said, lots of glass. The walls are pretty much entirely made of glass, kind of look like a long shipping container, but very sleek and nice. And as you said, the first 9 families did move into their units last week, about 35 residents. And here's Joe Campos, who is State Department of Human Services Deputy Director, speaking at the site shortly before that move-in, and you'll hear lots of ongoing construction noise in the background.
Kalaiʻola consists of 450 units, ranging from studios, one bedroom, two bedroom, and three bedrooms. It's designed in a layout that will allow for a sense of community. So if you look in this area right here, you can see that there's 3 units that are within, you know, close proximity, but still within the fire code, you know, to be 10 feet apart. And that's designed in case there are multi-generational ohana, you know, that they can be in a close proximity to each other, in which you have, you know, kapuna can be in one unit, the family can be in another unit. So it's all designed to develop a sense of community.
Yeah, I really like the little, you know, subdivision that they put up there. It just really looks nice.
Yeah, so it's 57 acres that they have prepared for this site, and it's going to be in different phases. At the end of the month, there's going to be another 53 units available, you know, all the way through March, the last 180 units will become available. And they've gone up quite quickly, and 90 of the units will look like these glass windowed units, not all of them will look like that. There were 4 different modular home providers that they worked with for this particular site, those 450 units. And so they'll all look a little bit different. But, you know, people have said, well, what about privacy? And there are curtains that go from the ceiling down to the floor. So if families do want to have privacy within their unit, that's certainly an option. And Campo said there's also an elective reflective glass film that residents can choose to put over those windows to give them a little bit extra privacy as well while letting in all of that light. And this housing will be for the next 5 years. So that's the time frame that we're looking at here for this temporary, little bit longer term housing for these fire survivors. The property after that will be turned over to DHHL. Some of the units may stay be transferred over to DHHL as well. It's not 100% clear what the future will hold for the unit specifically, but there will be no rent for these families until next August. So for 1 year, there'll be no expenses involved in living there. And then a determination will be made on having a nominal rent fee, what Campos described as covering operating costs. So it's not clear what that might be after that year point. But, you know, folks are starting to move in, and a lot more will be moving in over the next few months. And not too far away from that site, there's another temporary housing site going up called Kilohana. That has 169 units that is being developed by FEMA. And right now the site preparation work is underway, and that's being done by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And here's Eric Colonel Swenson describing the work that they're doing.
This is a two-phase operation here. Phase one is this heavy earthwork that the Corps of Engineers is responsible for. That includes power, water, sewer here on site. And then this phase two of this is when we're complete with those operations, FEMA has a contractors lined up, and they're gonna place the actual temporary housing site on top of it and do the final hookups. So this is sort of first phase heavy earthwork. That's what you hear behind you, those backup sirens.
Yeah, baby steps, right? A little at a time gets work done.
For sure. And that, as he said, includes all of the sewer lines that will actually be permanent and connect with folks on Fleming Road. It'll all be connected into the county system. And so it's not only temporary work that's being done, but also, you know, looking ahead to folks who are rebuilding in the area can be connected to that sewer line as well. So the earthwork for the Kilohana site is scheduled for completion in October. And then after that, you know, as he said, the modular homes will start going up in that area. And these are all for folks who don't qualify for FEMA assistance or other assistance. So there's options for folks who are, you know, still having trouble finding housing. And just a reminder, there are still about 40 families that are still living in hotels. And so a FEMA direct individual, individual assistance branch director told me that those families are looking to move into this Kilohana site that's still under development. So lots in the works here in the next few months.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was HPR's Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel. You can check out her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Alamoana Shopping Center celebrates its 65th anniversary this weekend, and one of its original tenants was Petland. Well, the small family business just announced it is closing its last retail store in Kahala. We talked to Rich Matsui, who says the decision that his dad Kenneth made was a tough one. The company was founded by Rich's grandfather, Jiro, who was a decorated member of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team and whose colorful side business selling goldfish in Chinatown was the foundation for Petland's growth.
It's so hard to top that greatest generation, those folks. So he was born and raised in Hawaii. He served in the 100th, the 442nd. So came back from World War II and, you know, like many vets, realized he needs to do something for a living. And so for him, he was a really talented goldfish breeder. And so one of the things that he did, in addition to taking classes at University of Hawaii, is that he would breed the goldfish, put them into plastic bags, put the plastic bags into a wheelbarrow, and cart that wheelbarrow up and down Chinatown, selling goldfish. And that's how he started the pet business. So like really one of these prototypical scrappy entrepreneur kind of stories. And you know, as an entrepreneur myself, like I do draw a lot of inspiration from what he did. But it's really hard to top what this guy did because of that sheer scrappiness of the story.
Yeah. I mean, and he's a veteran, right? I mean, gosh, the service and the courage from that time.
Yeah, they would always refuse to talk about it, but he did earn a Bronze Star. And I've learned later that you don't earn the Bronze Star without getting involved with combat.
Well, the decision then to close, because he then handed down the business to your dad.
That's right. And so my father's been running the business for, gosh, probably 30 odd years now.
And so what are your earliest memories of working in the store?
Oh my goodness, so many memories. So now that I'm a father of little toddlers, I think like the earliest memories are, I'm sure that I was maybe not being like the best kid. So they were keeping me in the little office, but in order to keep me entertained, they gave me a calculator, like that created little receipts, you know, but you punch in some numbers and some little paper spits out of it. And so I was just getting to play with that, you know, all evening, which was, you know, the best time, I suppose, when you're an 8 years old or maybe like a 5 year old kid.
It did the trick.
Yeah, it did the trick. So that kept me busy for a couple hours. So that was one. My sister and I we really grew up in those stores. Like we would, I think as with many folks in Hawaii, our parents voluntold us that we were going to, of course, put together some bird cages, haul some equipment from here to there. We did all of that, of course, but what we really enjoyed was playing with the puppies. And there was in particular these two puppies, two Welsh Corgi puppies, M&M and Cookie, we named them, which is a mistake. If you work at a pet store, a family pet store, you cannot name the dogs yourself because, of course, when they do inevitably move on, it's a more of a heart-wrenching experience than it really ought to be.
Oh, yeah. You give them up.
Yep, exactly. But I'm sure they went to great homes. But it's things like that that simultaneously makes this such like a difficult experience because of the fact that so much of our childhood is tied up with these businesses. But at the same time, just recognizing sometimes just the reality of the situation you're in makes this the right decision.
I talked to another local company, City Mail, Stephen I.E., and he had mentioned that they're really worried about Amazon coming in and just what we saw with the pandemic where people are buying things online. So I'm sure it's affecting your bottom line, you know, your survival.
Definitely. I think, I mean, our business, we survived through Walmart coming into the islands 20, 30 years ago. And I remember as a kid being pretty concerned about that. But, you know, my dad was quite confident we would get through that. And he was right. We got through Walmart. We got through Petco. I'm not convinced that we would have been able to survive through especially with the same day delivery that this Amazon warehouse is going to enable. between a cost, convenience, a number of other factors, of course, that Amazon's really able to compete with. I do worry about this generation of remaining local businesses that are trying to hold on here. I mean, for us, at least, it was made somewhat easier by the fact that it was a confluence of two factors. So the first was just the health scare that my father had. So that, of course, being a big one. But the other is really this economic angle that you're describing. And so, of course, the cost of doing business in Hawaii, everyone understands that to be a relatively challenging environment. But when I think about the go forward outlook, I would absolutely understand the point that the City Mill folks are making, is that we have a cost structure that is radically different than what these e-commerce folks are bringing to the table. And our ability to compete with them is going to be limited by our cost structure. And what makes me worried from a policy level is the fact that, look, it's probably the case that the last bastion of middle class in Hawaii are these small business owners. And how many hundreds of small businesses are, more or less retail companies like ours? And if that starts getting eaten away by a very large player with a seemingly limitless balance sheet, plus same day delivery, and of course, a competitive cost structure, we could see that erode quite quickly once this warehouse gets up and running. And what does that mean for us in Hawaii? I worry that this is going to exacerbate some of the income inequality and wealth inequality that we already see here. And I think that this conversation that we had in our family is something that hundreds, if not thousands, of families are having across the island right now.
Okay. So if people want to come and say goodbye to your family and your workers, because, you folks have been here for 80 years. I mean, how much time do we have left?
So the closing is forecast for September, and we don't have an exact date yet. Kind of depends on how things play out in the next couple of weeks. We do have at least a closing sale that we're able to offer for our loyal customers that have been with us for so many years. And so it's 30% off for most of the items available in the store. And we'll just be running that until we get to the close date. And thankfully, we still have our warehouse and our wholesale business that we'll continue to run.
And so talk about that wholesale business.
So my grandfather started both the retail and wholesale business, especially at that time. It was hard to start just a retail business because, of course, just the ability to import things first from the U.S. and then primarily from China was a core competence of the business at that point. And so we do have these two different levels of the business, but I think Petland is the last, certainly the largest remaining independent pet store. And so we've seen many of our competitors on the retail side also disappear and phase out over time. Some of these stores that I got to know very well, because of course we were serving them from a wholesale standpoint, even if we were nominally competing with them on the retail side. And so, I think over time, it's almost like you can see the well drying up here, right? The retail companies are going to be the first to have trouble. But then of course, there's the wholesalers that were supplying these retailers. And then of course, there's a bevy of service companies that were providing services to both the retailers and the wholesalers. I think there's going to be a bit of a chain reaction that we'll start to see as this progresses.
Well, what will you miss the most when you see this retail store closed down?
There's a lot of my childhood, involved in these pet stores. I think it's a very strange feeling to have this conversation with someone, because growing up, I thought I was going to be running this store someday. That was certainly the prevailing thought. Sometimes life doesn't quite take you in that direction. And so the idea that someday I might be talking to someone about closing it, one of the things I'm really excited about though is to be able to take conversations like these and save them, so that my kids can see it one day and to understand that, look, this is a thing that our family built and really helped to put me through school, my father through school, all the really important things in life, those milestones that would not have been possible had this family not invested and, of course, the community supported what we were doing.
We have been hearing from Rich Matsui, who is the grandson of Jiro Matsui, who started Petland 8 decades ago. The family is grateful for the community's support over the years. It plans to close its doors in Kahala in September. This week, our community lost a big literacy advocate, Wally Amos, famous Amos cookie entrepreneur who later in life did much to boost literacy in our state. We are fortunate to have in our studio today someone who shares Wally's passion for literacy. Kareem Weaver is all about The Right to Read. It's the title of a film that he's in and that is being screened at the Doris Duke Theater tomorrow. Weaver is also the co-founder of Fulcrum, which partners with other organizations to improve students' reading results.
Well, first of all, this isn't something that is new, not to me and anybody else. Everybody wants their kids to read. We just sometimes get distracted. We get busy with whatever else is going on in life in our day, but people care about their kids. it took a minute for me to just sift through, you know, all the busyness of life and really drill down on what's really important. What do I want for my babies? And, you know, the real question is, who's your neighbor? Because I want for my neighbor's kids the same thing I want for my kids, right? I want my kids to be all right. I want them to be able to read and make their way in life, whatever they choose to do. And I want the same thing for your kids. I want everybody's kids to be all right. So that means they have to be able to read, just at a basic level, be able to crack the code, be able to understand what things mean and put thoughts together. So that's, for me, that started a long, long time ago. It's just that I had to have life slow down enough for me to realize, hey, listen, I'm not getting no younger. Sometimes you got to just stop and make sure you're keeping the main thing. And then I realized everybody else is just busy doing their stuff too. But wait a second, well, who's making sure the kids can read? Oh, not that many people. Now listen, day to day, educators are doing it. Everybody's trying to, but I'm talking about who has their hand on the steering wheel, who's making adjustments, who is dictating policy, who's really focusing on this. So that's why I just like, you know what, enough's enough. This is my life's calling. This is what I want to do.
Well, you know, we've had folks like Wally Amos in our community, mm-hmm. who just have really felt that we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. And part of it is the family. And some of that comes from getting parents to get involved, you know, with story time at night. But, you know, some parents maybe don't know how to read, right. You know, and so you've got to kind of get through that.
That's why, you know, I hear people say all the time, well, we need more parent engagement or parent involvement. And listen, that's a good thing. Apparently, that's a great thing. And, you know, our schools are public institutions. We give them resources. We give them our tax dollars. We say, we need you to do this, this, and this. Keep them safe, right? You know, don't have them come home with a bandage on their head and teach them how to read. Everything else we can work on. We can work on whatever else. But those two basic things, that's part of the public trust. And at a federal level, you know, kids have a right to a free and appropriate public education. And it's just a civil right. At the end of the day, it's a civil right. Kids have access to civil rights. Because if you can't read, it's going to be tough for you to make your way, to just navigate society with whatever you choose to do. So, you know, whether it's here in Hawaii or California or New York, wherever it is, all kids means all kids. Kids, they may sound differently. They may look differently. Their grandparents may talk like whatever. Everybody wants their kids to be all right. And they need basic things in their backpack of life to be able to do that. Literacy skills is at the top of the list.
Yeah, whether you're from inner city or out in a rural area.
Yeah, it's actually one of the things that binds us, right? And I look at how partisan things are, the Democrat, Republican, Independent, Liberal, all this. Okay, well, you know what? Everybody wants their kids to read. I don't care if you're in Appalachia or if you're on the islands. Like we are, that's actually something we can agree on. And it may be one of the few saving graces that we have. Because it turns out that when people start working together on something and solving common problems, all of a sudden it humanizes people. And I think part of the fear of doing this and really moving together, not just as a state, but as a nation, is are we willing to actually humanize each other in the work? I'm almost afraid that if I do this, I might start liking you. Uh-oh. Then what do I do? You know what I mean? But we all want our kids to read. In fact, I tell people, if we disagree with things on things politically and all the rest, we should want each other's kids to read even more. Because I don't want them growing up thinking something I don't like just like you do. I want them to be able to read it for themselves. So it's just a matter of seeing the humanity in each other and making sure that we prioritize our children over any other divisions that might be out there.
Yeah, well, I think we have been fortunate that we've had lots of leaders in our community. Jed Gaines, you know, the Read to Me programs in the schools. I've taken part in many of those. And it's a delight, really, to engage with the children and bring your favorite storybook, you know, and just help support this love for learning and love for books. You know, a former first lady, you know, Governor Wahei's wife, she was an educator and was really active. So we've got lots of folks who are focused on children's literacy and adult literacy as well, you know, because this is all our kuleana. It's our responsibility to help our children.
Right. That's right. You know, I was talking to a guy this morning, and he works for an organization called Hawaii Kids Can, and I was explaining to him how, you know, I'm staying at this nice hotel that they got me put up at some real nice place. I really appreciate it. And I look out my window, and there's this beach, and it's everybody sunbathing, and they're doing all the things. They're enjoying this. And then there's this guy who he looks like he's homeless. I don't know, but he doesn't look like he's doing too well. So I went to all the events and I came back later at night and most of the beachgoers were gone, but he was still there. So I went down there and talked to him. And he was telling me he went to school in the city, private school, St. Louis. Apparently he played football. It was like a big deal for him. And he had all this stuff. And he was like, man, but I really couldn't read that good. You know, like they would help me, but not to indict any particular school. He was like, but I needed to really understand what I was doing. And I just remember thinking to myself, first of all, I mean, it's hard to say, but I wish all our kids, like we focused on our kids like they were all star athletes. And that when they no longer serve the purpose of being able to run the ball or catch the ball or whatever it is, that we still see them as useful members of society. Those are our children. I don't care if they ever touch a ball. That's my grandson. That's my niece, my daughter. Whatever it is, we have to get to the point where we see our children as family through and through, and not just to the extent that they're useful in whatever the endeavor is, like sports, whatever, but just because we love them and they're our priority. And if we have that attitude, man, the school's going to look a lot different. I'm talking about traditional public schools now. Fine, I know that school's a private school, right? But I'm talking about all schools and all kids. They all deserve a right to a good education. It starts with being able to read.
Right. You don't want any child left behind.
That's right. No, you're left behind. And look, you know, I'm from California, the Bay Area of California. It's a lot like Honolulu. It's expensive to live out here. You're like, this is one of those places where if you don't have a foundation, what are you going to do? Like, we have to really wrestle with that, because the implications in an area like this that's beautiful, it's majestic, and it's expensive. If you can't read, how are you going to make your way? And that's something that we just have to come to terms with. Children deserve a right to be able to pursue their goals and to have the potential to make it in this society.
Well, what strategies have worked for you in the Bay Area?
Well, it's not just the Bay Area, but it's around the country. So when I was a teacher, I'll use myself as an example. When I was a teacher, I really focused on foundational skills. And I taught a bilingual class for many years, 8 years strictly English and then probably 10 years of bilingual. And what worked for one worked for the other, which was we don't skip steps. We start at the very beginning. We develop our oral language and we walk it up one step at a time. You know, we learn the foundations. We learn how people hear sound and how they express sound, how they crack the code and put things together. And then we work on doing that at a pretty good space with speeds, which sounds like when you're listening to someone. And then from there, we get into meaning and all the rest like that. That's just, we call it the science of reading now, but that's just good teaching. You can call it what you want to, evidence-based instruction, science reading. It's just good teaching. Just don't skip steps. So it worked. In fact, it worked so well that the school district thought I was cheating. I kid you not. I got a letter that said the students' test scores on the latest district benchmark does not align with the district's expectations of students from this demographic. I'll never forget that.
Well, did it exceed it?
Yeah. So me being the type of person I am, I was like, oh, really? I photocopied that thing. I put it all on the bulletin boards. The parents were like, what? It's like, yeah, that's what it, because our expectations were so low for kids. And that's why I remember a former president, George Bush, he talked about the soft bigotry of low expectations. I don't think there's anything soft about it. Our kids are capable. They can do it if we give them what they need. So what I did was, to me, it was common sense. Right? Go in order, do it one step at a time. It's the same thing that they're doing in Mississippi, where the whole state, you know, they went from 50th in the state, now they're like 21st in the state in reading. They were doing the same approach. Places like Seaford, Delaware, we talked about recently, where they were last in the state, almost taken over because the reading was so bad. And now for fourth grade reading, they're tops in the state in a 6-year period. Like, it's not a snap. It's not overnight. It's a lot of hard work, but it is possible. It can be done.
I think of that line, what rising tide lifts all ships.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And that's important. That's important because there are people who say, well, I'm not so sure that's good for my kid. You know, my kid's going to be a good reader. So maybe that's for the kids who really can't read that. Well, that's for the kids who speak another language at home. I got news for you. Reading skills are good for all kids. And the stuff that we talk about in the science of reading, the foundational skills, that's good for everybody. Latin and Greek roots. Guess what? You take the SAT, they're going to ask you about some Latin degree. So it just makes, and it helps binds, it connects things in our brain. That's one of the things it talks about in that Right to Read movie, about how the science of learning impacts our brain functioning, our neurology, creates new pathways. And so when you speak multiple languages, when you understand what things mean in different contexts, you can kind of make a bigger, more comprehensive picture of things. But it's absolutely doable at the state level, at the district level. Well, Hawaii, it's the same thing. At the school level, at the individual classroom level, and at the home level. For those who are homeschooling kids, they can do it. I don't care what their background is, socioeconomically, culturally, or whatever, kids can learn to read if we teach them.
You know, following our interview this morning, Weaver was scheduled to meet with members of the Hawaii School Board to talk about his passion to make sure that all of our keiki learn to read and that no one gets left behind. Weaver will be on hand when the film Right to Read screens tomorrow at the Honolulu Museum of Art at the Doris Duke Theater. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Gas, celebrating 120 years in Hawaii and committed to advancing the state's clean energy goals. Annual sustainability reports at hawaiigas.com.
Ben Rosenberg used to live near a park where everyone let their dogs off leash, even though there were signs explicitly saying not to do so.
And as soon as a cop would drive by, like, everybody would find their dog, put him on leash, and scatter. I mean, it was just a wild experience.
The curious ways in which we respond to rules, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from Malama Ola Health Services on Oahu, committed to helping patients, families, and caregivers with personalized hospice and palliative care. Available 24/7 at 808-543-1188.
You know, it's still August, but Tony Meredith at the Aloha Ballroom Company is already working on something special for Halloween. The champion dancer and choreographer is planning a flash mob here on Oahu to the tune of Michael Jackson's iconic hit, Thriller. We don't see many flash mobs here, so if you're unfamiliar with the term, it's a group of people that assemble suddenly in a public place, perform for a brief time, and then go their separate ways. The conversations with Subiono thought it sounded like a great time, so members of our production team took a trip to Aloha Ballroom Company to learn a few moves.
Good to see you, man.
All right.
This is Jody.
Hey, Jody.
And this is...
Nice to meet you.
Maya, nice to meet you.
I'm glad you came. All right. Well, Hey, man, thanks for letting us come by and hang out and learn more about this flash mob coming up. What prompted you to want to do a flash mob?
Well, you know, I've always been a fan of Michael Jackson as far as dancing goes. And I had a studio in New York, and I also had a studio in Columbus, Ohio. And that was an annual event that we had carried on for like the last, you know, 15 years, 10, 15 years. And because dance and the music is so iconic, you know, it's actually in its 42nd year of ongoing, you know, one of the favorite, most popular dances as far as flash mobs. I just moved to Hawaii and I thought this is the place to like just share it with everybody. And, you know, after COVID, everything's been bringing the community back together and getting everybody outside and dancing and having fun. So that was the main goal.
I don't know that we see a whole lot of flash mobs here. So can you maybe describe what it is? I'm positive people kind of have an idea, but in your words, what a flash mob is.
Well, a flash mob, it is a surprise performance by a group of people that have been working and practicing dance moves or a dance style or a favorite song. And a flash mob is it could happen at any location, anywhere, anytime. This one, of course, is towards Halloween, which is basically what we're, you know, aiming for in that direction. And we thought we'd get an early start. You know, it's already August. September. I mean, Halloween comes fast, you know. And it's also, again, I think people love Halloween. They love dressing up. And this gives them an idea of a direction where they can go with their costumes and performing with a group, with the community. And it's something different. Yeah, it's a surprise at any time. Yeah. It could happen now.
It could happen right now.
Exactly.
When you have a flash mob, It's a lot of individuals who are coordinated to dance to the same music, but maybe they might not know each other, or maybe they're spread out over the area of a certain place. What kind of coordination does it take? How do you work the coordination when it could be, you know, spread out over a large area?
It's basically, of course, you know, we're working with counts of eight, and there could be several different counts of eight within this routine. And the choreography is kind of set, and it's also set to this music. So it's really kind of like always organized in the sense of numbers. The great part of a flash mob is that you don't have to be a professional, because you're not required to be specific. You're not being judged on tick. It's to be fun and have the idea of like joining and camaraderie. But also in a flash mob, it's interesting that people that are not a part of that flash mob seem to like give you space, and they create this space, which also, you know, in this particular routine also encompasses everybody close to each other, you know? So it's like this whole volume, like, you know, when you see a school of fish, you're going, you know, they're swimming all around, and you're so surprised by it that you sort of like take a step back and look at it. Same thing with a flash mob, you know, but they get to enjoy it. And they also know the music. It's been around for ages, and it's like, it is. The song is a real icon.
It seems like one of the cool things about flash mobs is that you can be any skill level when it comes to dance. There could be people that could do everything to the T, and there's others who maybe freestyle a little bit, right? There's some open opportunity for people to kind of put their spin on it too, right?
Absolutely. We always encourage like individualism, and you know, we give you the steps, the figures, the idea, the concept, the character, but then you own it, you take it, you make it your own. You know, we want to celebrate that, you know, go for it. What do we say? Go for it.
Yeah. So in this particular case, you are the owner of Aloha Ballroom Company. Is this flash mob, is it going to be ballroom dancing when Thriller is played, or is it like what we saw in the video? What kind of moves are we talking about?
We are going to do what's in the video. You know, Michael Peters, the choreographer of the piece at the time, was creating, probably without realizing it, such the iconic choreography around the world. When Michael Jackson passed away in, I think it was 2009, Mexico City had the largest Thriller choreography done. Like, there were over 14,000 people. Now, I don't know if we're going to get 14,000 people here in Hawaii, but, you know, we want to start it up. Maybe it'll keep growing, because it is an annual event that we do. So we want to just kind of continue to like share that, encourage everybody to come, be a part of the team, be a part of the mob, the Hawaii flash mob.
Tell us some of the details about this particular flash mob. I know that you're offering rehearsals all the way up until the day of the event. So tell us about the classes that are being offered and how people can partake of those classes.
Right. We're starting our classes on August 18th. We have scheduled at 1 o'clock for one class. We already are like filled in that first part of the class. So we might be holding a second class at 1:45. There'll be 10 different classes that we're definitely going to guarantee that we're going to set up. If we need more, we can do that. The classes are $30 a piece. Whatever you can maintain, hold, you know, retain, that's great. You know, and again, like I said, make it your own. The flash mob is going to be around the 26th of October, but at a surprise undisclosed location until that day.
You've mentioned that you've been a participant in flash mobs in the past. When you talk to people who have participated, what do they get from it? What kind of stories have you heard about what they get from being in one of your flash mobs?
You know, that's such a great question, because I think it is a thriller in the sense of this particular song, but even any flash mob that we've done in the past, people walk away with a sense of accomplishment, joy, a group effort. I can't say it's like the Olympics, but you know, there's that feeling of like accomplishing something and doing it and seeing it through. And I think also the creativity that people find inside themselves, it surprises me, like when they come out with like different costumes and their hair and their makeup and these zombies, they're looking like werewolves and all that. It's fun to see all of that. It's community and involvement and getting everybody participating.
Well, one of us is going to do some dance moves if you're willing to teach us maybe a few steps that are from the Thriller song or that people would be using in the flash mob. Everyone's looking at me, so I guess I'll be the one to learn. So if you're willing, can you teach me a few steps?
I am thrilled and honored to show you how to do the Thriller choreography. I've got my team with me here also. I've got Maya and I've got Jody to help me. We're going to sort it all out, Russell. Let's go.
All right, let's do this. I'm going to give it my best shot.
Okay.
I feel good.
Now just stay with the timing, stay with the rhythm. Okay. If I embellish some movements, don't worry about it. You might even go like this. One, three, good. Here we go, ready? Not yet. Five, six, zombie walk. One, two, three, five, six, seven. You click your head. Three, five, six. Your hands go out. One, three, five. You scratch, scratch. Five, six, seven, eight. Wow, Russell, you got it. You got it.
Thank you.
It seems like it's easy, and it is. But that's why it takes 10 lessons to actually, at least minimum, to kind of like really get the full embodiment, the character.
Definitely helps with the music. Being able to feel the beat and to hear the rhythm.
Absolutely, yeah. And then, of course, you know, repetition is the mother of skill. Mm-hmm. Repetition, 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 whether it's in academics, physicality, musicality, Olympians, is repetition.
Okay, yeah,
let's
do it.
Let's go for it.
Yeah.
See, that's what you need is that kind of like, let's do it. Let's go for it. Let's hit it.
All right.
Yes. Beautiful. See, then calling out the words where you kind of like help. Yeah. You wait for the sound. Ta-da! Zombie walk. Here we go. One, three, five. Between done. One. Five, arms up. One, three, five. You smash forward with the right foot. Left foot. You jump forward. Hey! And you get five. And you're a big. Yeah! Woo-hoo!
That's good.
Yeah, of course, anytime. After you stop by and learn how to dance, you know, you could also do cha-cha, samba, waltz, tango, all these different dances, hustle, West Coast swing.
Perfect.
Bring your flavor into the dance.
Bring your flavor.
Why not? Well, I really appreciate it. I appreciate you guys' help. I'm so rusty, but it was a hell of a lot of fun.
Listen, for the amount of time that we did it in like 5-10 minutes, you picked up really great.
I appreciate
it. I actually hope to see you out there on the mob.
Oh, I would love to.
Wouldn't that be a surprise?
Oh, that would be really cool. Yeah. Right on. Well, thanks so much for your time. Yeah. Totally appreciate it.
Absolutely, brother.
All right, man.
Anytime. Anytime. Our pleasure.
All right. We're good.
Well, that was HPR's Russell Subiono learning some moves with Aloha Ballroom Company owner Tony Meredith. Meredith will be holding the first of 10 instructional classes for Halloween Flash Mob. They'll be dancing to Michael Jackson's Thriller. And that'll be starting this Sunday, August 18th. We will have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website after the show. Well, that's it for us today. Up tomorrow, with the start of the NFL season approaching, we will have a Hunho show featuring recent football interviews. Give us some feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Google, Apple, or Spotify. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.